disturbances that continue for months or years. Still, if your child has consistently poor sleep, and you have ruled out the more common causes, or, of course, if you know that your child has a significant medical problem, then you may have to consider a medical cause. Colic. In the early months, probably the most common cause of significant sleep disturbances is colic, a condition in which a baby has frequent spells of intense crying and is difficult to soothe. The episodes begin to appear in the first weeks after birth. They usually occur in the late afternoon or evening and can go on for several hours. If your baby is colicky, you may find you can help only by walking around with him for hours or by placing him over your legs while you rub his back. Often, nothing you do may seem to help. A colicky baby often has a distended stomach. His legs will likely be pulled up toward his chest, and he may seem to feel relief when he passes gas or has a bowel movement. For these reasons, it is commonly assumed that colic is caused by intestinal pain. Whether that is true, or always true, remains uncertain, but in very severe cases of colic, a pediatrician may prescribe medication to relax the bowels and ease the apparent discomfort. On the other hand, it's possible that the distension, the gas, and at least some of the apparent discomfort may actually be caused by air swallowed during long periods of vigorous crying. The initial reason why the baby started crying, or cries so long and so hard, may be something else entirely. Another possible contributing factor is sensory overstimulation. Colicky infants often seem to be unusually sensitive to events happening around them, or to excessive handling and other stimulation, or at least they behave as if that is the case. Many professionals have concluded that these children see, hear, and feel the world about them as an unpleasant and disorganized barrage of sensations. This chaotic input would be difficult for an infant to handle. The child could become upset and build up so much tension throughout the day that his coping abilities become overloaded. He would need to discharge this accumulated tension at the end of the day. Whether or not this explanation is true, colicky babies do act as if they need to cry and seem to do better when allowed to do so for a while. If your baby seems to have colic, you should first try to comfort him. You might try rocking him gently, feeding him, or giving him a pacifier. If you find he cannot easily be comforted, allow him to cry for 15 minutes while held calmly or alone in his crib. If he is not settled by then, try again to console him. Be calm and speak softly. Try not to become frantic, and don't do anything too vigorous, such as bouncing him or running around the room with him. If he still isn't comforted, try again every 15 minutes or so. Remember, since colicky babies seem to benefit from a period of crying, you are actually responding to his needs by letting him cry for a while. If you try too hard to stop the crying, you might just overstimulate him and make things worse. If he needed to be held, nursed, or rocked, or just wanted to use a pacifier, then those interventions would have calmed him down. A child's colic often improves if he is allowed to cry undisturbed for just two or three consecutive colicky periods. His crying spells may get shorter and less intense in a day or two, and if they do, he will probably sleep better as well. Babies hospitalized for severe colic often seem to be cured just by being in the hospital, probably because nurses are more likely than parents to allow an infant periods to cry by himself if he does not accept comforting. Colic is discussed in all books on baby care, and if your baby suffers from it, you should also talk it over with your pediatrician. In almost all cases, the symptoms completely disappear by the time the child reaches 3 months of age. However, although colic is not in and of itself a sleep disorder, colicky infants often do develop long-standing sleep problems. These ongoing problems may look the same as those the baby suffered from during the colicky months, but they are not. What happens is that the habits formed when your child was colicky can persist after the colic has disappeared. You may have spent a great deal of time walking, rocking, and holding him, and otherwise trying to comfort him to help him get to sleep. Once the colic is gone, your child may still demand these rituals, not because he is in distress, despite his crying, but because he has come to expect them. If that happens, you will have to help him learn new, more appropriate associations with falling asleep, as discussed in Chapter 4. The biggest difficulty here is deciding when the colic is gone. It goes away gradually, not overnight, so it may not be obvious to you when the time has come to change your responses. Keep in mind that colic is usually gone by the age of 3 months, and that it occurs during the day, not just during normal sleep hours. In fact, colic tends to be most severe in the evening, suggesting an interaction with underlying circadian rhythms, although it is not known which hormones or bodily functions may be involved. A colicky baby appears to be genuinely distressed, as if he is in pain and not merely hungry, frustrated, or angry, and it is difficult to ease a colicky baby's suffering. So it is unlikely that colic is still the problem if your baby cries mainly at bedtime and during the night, if, despite the crying, he does not appear to be in pain. If the crying stops promptly when you pat his back, rock him, give him a pacifier, or feed him, and if you can get him to return to sleep quickly when he does wake. Once you have realized that, you can go on to identify the real cause of the persisting sleep problem and take steps to correct it. If you don't, it may continue for months or even years. Chronic illness. Chronic medical conditions can contribute to ongoing sleep disturbances in a variety of ways. A child's illness may cause pain or discomfort. Skin irritation causes annoying itching. Migraines cause nighttime headaches and nausea. Asthma makes breathing difficult. His sleep may be disrupted by the specific symptoms of his disease or disorder. Perhaps he wakes feeling jittery or needing to urinate because of poorly controlled diabetes. Or his sleep may be broken by epileptic seizures. The indirect consequences of a medical disorder can also cause trouble. For example, certain medications have side effects that interfere with sleep. An orthopedic brace can cause discomfort or limit a child's ability to move. And even a child's anxieties about his condition can keep him awake. If your child suffers from a chronic medical problem, you're probably well aware of it. The difficulty lies in sorting out which factors related to the illness, if any, are disrupting his sleep. Several factors may be contributing at once. This can be a very complex problem, possibly too difficult for you to solve alone. Ask your pediatrician or specialist for help. Several conditions do merit special discussion here. Nocturnal pain. When pain at night affects sleep, it is the pain, not the sleep itself, that must be treated. In most cases, for example, when a child is up at night after sustaining an injury or while teething, it is clear what is happening, and the solution is as simple as relieving the pain with medications or other treatments. Fortunately, most causes of pain are easy to recognize and resolve quickly. However, there are two especially common ones that often go unrecognized for long periods of time: middle ear disease, and gastroesophageal reflux. Nighttime pain from these or other causes often wakes children at unpredictable times during the night, not at a regular time, say, always an hour after the child falls asleep. If your child is awakened in pain, he will probably be crying and unhappy, and there will be no easy way to stop it. It makes little difference where he is. If he usually stops crying quickly and seems fine once you pick him up or allow him something he wants, then he's probably not in pain. Similarly, if he cries every night in his own bed, but always sleeps soundly when you let him sleep in your bed, look for an explanation other than pain. He could not be suffering from reflux or middle ear disease only when in his own bed, after all. Middle ear disease. Once identified, chronic middle ear disease is usually easy to treat. In this condition, fluid collects in the middle ear cavity behind the eardrum and does not drain satisfactorily. This fluid can become infected, but even if it doesn't, the fluid buildup alone can lead to a temporary loss of hearing, and if the fluid remains there long enough, it can permanently damage the bones of the middle ear. When a child's middle ear is acutely infected, pressure in the middle ear cavity increases, the eardrum bulges, and the child likely experiences pain. When the fluid does not become infected, children usually don't complain of pain, but their sleep may nonetheless be disrupted. It is not clear how or why. It may be that when the child is lying down, the middle ear drains less effectively than at other times. More fluid collects, pressure increases to a degree, and the child feels enough discomfort to interrupt his sleep. Whatever the cause, children with persistent fluid behind the eardrum sometimes have significant sleep disturbances that cannot be explained any other way. It is striking that when these children are treated with proper medication, or if necessary, by having drainage tubes inserted through the eardrums, not only are their middle ear problems cured, but often the sleep disturbances disappear as well. Caroline was an 18-month-old girl who had a long history of frequent wakings at night, despite the fact that she went to bed easily. On waking, she usually cried. She calmed down somewhat if her parents picked her up, but she had a hard time getting back to sleep, no matter what her parents did. Even when they walked with her or rocked her, she usually whimpered for 10 or 15 minutes before finally going back to sleep. Nothing they tried seemed to help at all. Caroline's history did not suggest an obvious cause for her sleep disturbance, but her parents did report that Caroline had had 3 or 4 ear infections over the past year. When I see a child with sleep problems like Caroline's, frequent unhappy nighttime wakings, with difficulty returning to sleep regardless of anything the parents do, I always take a careful look at the child's eardrums before deciding on a diagnosis and plan of therapy. In Caroline's case, I found that she still had a buildup of fluid behind her eardrums. Not only were her ears better treated with drainage tubes, but her sleep problems went away, and we avoided a series of behavioral treatments that, in her case, would not have worked. Gastroesophageal reflux. Another cause of nighttime pain is gastroesophageal reflux, what we commonly call heartburn. Ordinarily, food passes down from the mouth through the esophagus and then through a valve that keeps food in the stomach and prevents it from coming back up. This valve often functions imperfectly in early infancy, which is why spitting up is so common. Other problems with the normal passage of food out of the stomach into the intestines can complicate the problem further. Occasional spitting up in itself is no more than an annoyance, and most reflux material is cleared fairly rapidly from the esophagus by swallowing. But if stomach contents, which are very acidic, are repeatedly regurgitated into the esophagus and remain there too long, they can burn and even scar it. Occasionally, some acid even spills over into the trachea, windpipe, and possibly down into the lungs, causing coughing, gagging, and occasionally pneumonia. Pediatricians and gastroenterologists have good techniques for evaluating these symptoms and many effective medicines to treat the problem. You should not hesitate to consult them. When a young child is frequently up at night crying inconsolably, pain from reflux is one of the causes we must consider. Reflux occurs more often when a child is active than during sleep. Most episodes of reflux at night are actually caused by movement and crying, not vice versa. Children with reflux generally also show symptoms during the day. They spit up frequently and perhaps gag and choke. If your child has no such symptoms during the day, then it is unlikely that he is experiencing much reflux at night. When a child's symptoms suggest reflux as a possibility, further evaluation may be indicated, possibly including X-ray studies or direct monitoring of the level of acid in the esophagus. Occasionally, we simultaneously monitor a child's sleep and reflux patterns overnight in the sleep laboratory to see if reflux is actually causing discomfort and wakefulness. Treatment is generally by antacid or anti-reflux medication, sometimes started on a trial basis to help make the diagnosis. Surgery is only rarely indicated. Medication. Sleep medication is very frequently misused. In recent years, doctors have begun to appreciate that sleeping pills have caused far more sleep disorders in adults than they have ever cured. That is equally true with youngsters. A child receiving sleep medication regularly may reach a point where, without the medication, he cannot sleep, yet his sleep on the medication is of poor quality. When a child is not sleeping well and nothing seems to help, the family feels frustrated and hopeless, and they often beg the doctor for help. Often, the doctor will prescribe some sort of sleep medication. The ones most commonly used are the antihistamines, such as diphenhydramine, Benadryl, certain medicines for high blood pressure, such as clonidine, Ketapress, and certain drugs used to treat depression, such as trazodone, Desiril. All of these drugs cause sleepiness as a side effect. Major sedatives such as chloral hydrate and even major tranquilizers such as those related to diazepam, Valium, are often tried as well. Yet such medications rarely solve the sleep problems of a child who is otherwise normal and healthy. A child may even have so-called paradoxical response to the medication, becoming hyper and unable to sit still or sleep. In some conditions, such as sleep apnea, refer to Chapter 17, certain medications can be very dangerous. Even if your child sleeps well on medication, he will be far better off if you can determine the cause of the disturbance and help him learn to sleep well without drugs. Sometimes medication improves a child's sleep for several nights, even for a few weeks, but usually the old pattern returns. Besides, the stronger medications often affect a child's daytime mood and level of functioning. He may become overactive or clingy, cranky, and babyish. Only occasionally will a short 1 to 2 week course of drug treatment break the cycle of a poor sleep pattern and allow a good one to emerge so that normal sleep persists after the medication is stopped. If this treatment succeeds, the medication probably did no harm, but proper behavioral approaches would probably also have been successful. If you are able to correct your child's sleep without medicine, you will avoid the nagging anxiety that he has an underlying medical or neurological problem that keeps him from sleeping well, and you will feel more confident in dealing with any problems that may emerge in the future, without feeling that you have to head immediately for the medicine cabinet. In my practice, I see far too many young children who have been given powerful medications in an attempt to relieve sleep disorders that could be corrected by other means. In many cases, whatever the child's problem, the medication only makes matters worse. Also, the child's daytime behavior and his ability to concentrate and learn may well be compromised. This was the case with Joshua. Joshua was a 4-year-old boy described by his family as tense and irritable. His parents said he had great difficulty sleeping at night and wasn't very happy during the day. Because of the boy's repeated nighttime wakings and his behavioral difficulties during the day, which were probably the result of his poor sleep, his parents had sought medical advice. Joshua ended up on 3 medications: a long-acting stimulant taken in the morning, a drug to induce sleep at bedtime, and an even stronger sleeping pill to be taken if he didn't fall asleep quickly or woke again later in the night. He had been on these medications for 10 months. Joshua was so clearly an unhappy and irritable child that I was quite concerned. He interacted poorly with adults and peers, and I felt that a complete psychological evaluation would likely be needed. But first, to get a clearer picture of the situation and to establish a baseline for making further decisions, I had the family gradually stop Joshua's medications altogether. We also discussed changes to his sleep schedule and bedtime routines, and ways for his parents to set limits. Joshua agreed to cooperate in exchange for stickers and prizes. When I saw the family several weeks later, Joshua's parents were already vastly relieved. After a few difficult nights in the beginning, Joshua had begun going to bed easily and sleeping through the night for the first time in a year. In addition, he was much happier in the daytime, and his parents had begun to enjoy his company again. When I saw him in my office, Joshua was smiling, obviously happy, and good-natured in our conversation. In short, he was a delightfully normal 4-year-old. His good sleep pattern and normal daytime behavior have continued, and there has been no need for further intervention. I almost never recommend medication for a child with difficulty falling or staying asleep, and when I begin to treat a child who has been taking medication just for his sleep, I usually try to arrange for a trial period off of the medication before doing anything else, as I did with Joshua. If your child is on medication just to help him sleep, you may want to speak with your doctor about doing the same. Your child, of course, may have to take medications to treat other medical conditions. Phenobarbital and other drugs with sedative properties are often used in the treatment of epilepsy. Theophylline, Slofylline, Slobid, Aminophylline, Phylacontin, Trufylin, Metoproterenol, Alupent, Albuterol, Ventolin, Proventil, Terbutaline, Brethine, Bricanyl, and other similar medications with stimulant properties are used to treat asthma. Other stimulant drugs such as the amphetamines, dexedrine, Adderall, or methylphenidate, Ritalin, Concerta, may be used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Some children need antibiotics on an ongoing basis as protection against recurrent infections. These and many other medications can interfere with proper sleep. Again, the various effects of the underlying medical disorder, the medication, and other causes of sleep problems have to be sorted out. Not always an easy task. The dilemma can be further complicated if your child has had many hospitalizations and has become fearful at night, or if you, understandably, find it hard to set firm limits for your child because of his illness. If it seems possible that medication may be causing the sleep problem, you should raise the issue with your doctor and discuss the several approaches that may be helpful. You may be able to change your child's dosage or the time of day when he takes the drugs, or your doctor may be able to suggest alternative drugs. Even a temporary change will help you determine whether the original medicine was causing the sleep problem. Asthma medications taken by mouth may also be available as an inhalant with fewer side effects. Antibiotics themselves are unlikely to cause much of a sleep problem, but the additives in the liquid preparations may. Switching to pills, or even to a different brand of liquid, may be helpful. In any case, these changes will take time and require a certain amount of trial and error. But do not make any changes before you talk to your child's specialist. With his or her help, significant improvements may well be possible. Abnormal brain function and a true inability to sleep well. On occasion, I see children who appear to sleep poorly because of some impairment in the brain mechanisms that control one aspect or another of sleep. Most of these children show general impairment significant enough to be obvious. Usually they are mentally retarded, they may suffer from spasticity and seizures, and they may be blind or deaf. When such a neurological disorder is accompanied by a sleep disorder, we have to consider all the possibilities very carefully. For example, the child could have any of the sleep problems described in this book apart from his illness. And those problems can be solved in much the same way as for any other child. If your child has a neurological disorder or sensory impairment, it may be especially difficult for you to be firm at night, enforcing new patterns and setting new limits. But often, the only way to solve his sleep problem is to accept that there will be some crying, as, for example, you help him learn new associations with falling asleep. Refer to Chapter 4. Although it may seem harsh, it is in your child's best interest. You may just have to proceed more slowly than you would in the absence of the disorder. Instead of setting an initial goal of being out of the room while he falls asleep, say, you might simply work on helping him learn to fall asleep while you are out of his bed, even if initially you remain in the same room. Correcting an inappropriate sleep schedule is easier. And it is especially important for children with visual handicaps who have an impaired ability to rely on daylight to control their body rhythms. Refer to chapters 9 through 12. As I've described, medications that your child is taking for his disorder could also be a source of his sleep problems. Finally, your child's neurological impairments could be directly responsible for his inability to sleep. That is, the brain systems that control sleep may not be working properly. When I treat a child who is neurologically impaired, I first try to identify and treat factors apart from the brain damage, such as medication, inappropriate sleep associations, or schedule problems. More often than not, this approach leads to a successful outcome, and the child's sleep problem is resolved in spite of the neurological disorder. Only after all other factors are eliminated do I conclude that the child is sleeping poorly as a direct result of the brain damage. Sarah was a 6-year-old girl with muscular dystrophy, which left her severely compromised. She was largely confined to bed, although she spent part of the day in a wheelchair. She took one medication to help keep her muscles relaxed. Though she could not speak, she understood much of what went on around her. Her parents were devoted to her. They did not, however, like the fact that Sarah slept only about 5 hours each night, usually from midnight to 5 a.m. If she was put to bed early, she made noise until her parents came and stayed with her or brought her into the other room with them. Neither behavioral changes nor sleep-inducing medication seemed to help. The family had been told that the problem was part of Sarah's illness and that there was little that could be done. However, when I met Sarah, I discovered that, although she slept little at night, she usually slept about 4 hours during the day. She spent much of the daytime in bed, and when she was alone, she often fell asleep for up to 3 hours at a time. This was due mainly to habit, not to the sedating effects of her muscle relaxant medication, since her sleep pattern changed little when the medication was temporarily discontinued. It was clear to me that despite her neurological illness, Sarah had a normal sleep requirement. The problem was that too much of her sleep took place in the daytime. Even though Sarah had had this problem for years, it was fairly easy to fix. I simply asked her parents to keep her awake all day. They needed to get her out of bed more often, and at first someone had to be with her almost all the time to be sure she did not doze. I also changed the dosage and timing of her daily medication. Once Sarah was no longer allowed to sleep so much during the day, she started sleeping more at night. Within 2 weeks, she was sleeping from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. and never took more than a one-hour nap. Although Sarah had a severe neurological illness, it was not the illness or even her medication that directly caused her sleep problem, but her sleep schedule. The solution was an adjustment to her hours of sleep, not more medication. Nicholas was a 4-year-old boy who was moderately retarded because of a birth injury. He had always been a poor sleeper and was now falling asleep no earlier than 10 o'clock in the evening, albeit fairly easily, and waking at about 4 o'clock in the morning, after which he would stay awake for several hours, or even the rest of the night. On waking, he would call out, throw toys around the room, and bang his head against the wall. During the day, Nicholas sometimes napped for about 30 minutes, rarely longer. Nicholas's parents wanted very much to keep him at home instead of placing him in a residential treatment program, but getting up with him every night was a tremendous strain, and some of Nicholas's behavior posed dangers to him. We began Nicholas's treatment by changing all of the possible behavioral factors we could identify, including how his parents handled his bedtime routines and responded to his nighttime wakings. But he showed only slight improvement over a period of several months. Eventually, I had to conclude that behavioral intervention would not work, and that he had a true inability to get the sleep he needed. The only other explanation, which seemed unlikely, was that he simply didn't need very much sleep, although even if that were the case, we had to do something since he could not continue to live at home if he slept so little. In an extreme case like Nicholas's, when I know that brain function has been impaired and I'm convinced that the impairment is responsible for the sleep disturbance, I will consider the use of medication. Sedatives are sometimes effective. There have been a few reports suggesting that melatonin, a hormone sold in health food sections that is normally secreted during nighttime sleep periods, refer to chapters 9 and 10, can help children like Nicholas, and as far as we know at this writing, it is probably a relatively benign drug. We do not yet know for sure what side effects it may have, especially when it is used for a long time. However, I have not found it particularly helpful. Usually we must resort to stronger medications. There is no single medication that is helpful to all children like Nicholas, and not all children respond best to the same drug. While I greatly prefer not to use such drugs, they do help children like Nicholas to go to sleep more easily, and more important, to sleep long enough for them and their families to get sufficient rest. With the help of medication, Nicholas began sleeping from 9:30 p.m. to 6 a.m. While he was still getting less sleep than the normal amount for his age, this was a major improvement, and it made life much easier for his parents. In addition, as is typical of children with neurological impairment, Nicholas seemed to show no lingering drug effects in the morning, and his teacher said he seemed more alert. Results like these suggest that children such as Nicholas are not sleeping poorly just because their sleep requirements are short. It is also interesting that such children may continue to sleep well even when they are prescribed medication for extended periods, whereas in a normal child, the same medications usually become less effective over time and eventually create new sleep problems. When I must recommend medication, I continue to monitor the child carefully, and at intervals we decrease the dosage or stop the medication altogether to see if it is still needed. Most of these drugs require prescriptions and can only be managed under the care of a doctor. My experience shows that when neurologically impaired children require medication to help them sleep, they often need a fairly powerful drug and in substantial doses. If a child shows improvement on a mild medication such as an antihistamine, then I am convinced that he can get the same improvement without drugs. If your child is neurologically impaired and not sleeping well, you may consider discussing a trial of medication with your doctor. But before you decide to give your child a strong sleep medication, do try to identify other possible causes and to regulate his sleep patterns according to the methods outlined in this book. The behavioral approach has been successful with many neurologically impaired children, and it just might be all that your child needs. Part 3. Schedules and Sleep Rhythm Disturbances. Chapter 9. Schedules and Rhythms. Children commonly experience sleep disturbances caused by problems in the timing of their sleeping and waking patterns and in their daily routines. Their schedules may be too irregular. They may be regular, but inappropriate in certain ways. Or a child may just not be sleeping when her parents want her to sleep. If your child's daily patterns are inconsistent, then her sleep at night may be broken. If she naps or eats at unusual times, then she may wake too early in the morning or fall asleep too late at night. If she has become accustomed to sleeping at the wrong hours, then she may be unable to fall asleep as early or sleep as late as you wish. Many sleep problems can be treated simply by adjusting the underlying sleep schedule. In other cases, an improper sleep schedule is only part of the problem, but still a very important one. If your child isn't tired when you want her to go to sleep, you might rock her or give her a bottle to try to help her settle down, and in the process you may inadvertently teach her to associate these activities with falling asleep. Or if you have difficulty setting firm limits at bedtime, your child may always stay up too late, and the time at which she gets sleepy may shift. When a child has a sleep problem that includes a disturbance in her sleep rhythm, it will probably not be enough simply to correct her sleep associations or set firmer limits at bedtime. You will have to correct her schedule as well. To make corrections, in fact, to understand and treat any child's sleep problem properly, you must first understand the rhythm of her sleep-wake pattern. When parents have trouble treating their child's sleep problems, it is often because they haven't considered her schedule. Whenever a family consults me about a child's sleep problem, I always ask when their child goes to bed, when she actually falls asleep, when she wakes in the morning, and when she sleeps during the day. I also need to know when she is awake at night and for how long, whether she wakes on her own or has to be wakened in the morning and from naps, whether her schedule changes on weekends and vacations, and whether her schedule varies when cared for by different adults under different bedtime conditions or in different sleep locations. Without at least this basic schedule information, it is impossible to make any informed recommendations. Why is this information so critical? The answer has to do with the body's circadian rhythms. The term circadian, literally meaning approximately one day, refers to changes in an organism's biological systems that cycle approximately every 24 hours. Nearly all living things exhibit these rhythms. A branch of science called circadian biology studies them in plants and animals, and discoveries in this field have been truly astounding. Clever and sophisticated experiments have given us a much improved understanding of how circadian rhythms are set and how they control sleep and waking. With these scientific advances, our understanding of sleep and sleep problems in children has improved considerably, and we can use this knowledge to develop rational treatment programs. The circadian control of our body rhythms begins before birth, and the same basic pattern of control persists across all ages. The main concepts discussed here apply equally well to adults and children. The regular alternation between sleeping and waking is an obvious example of this circadian pattern, but in fact all of your body's physiological systems follow a daily cycle as well. There are predictable daily variations in hormone levels, body temperature, intestinal activity, urine output, and even immune system function. Steroid levels drop at night and rise toward morning. Body temperature does the same. The level of melatonin, a hormone secreted by the pineal gland, rises at night in the dark and drops during the day in the light. None of this happens by coincidence. These cycles are all controlled by the biological clock, also called the circadian or central pacemaker. This pacemaker consists of a group of cells located in the hypothalamus, a primitive area of the brain that, in addition to its circadian effects, also directly governs minute-to-minute changes in hormone levels, appetite, blood pressure, and other basic functions. In humans, the circadian pacemaker tends to run a little slow. If we allowed it to run freely, it would take about 10 minutes longer than a standard 24-hour day to complete one cycle. Yet we normally operate, or should operate, on an exact 24-hour day. We manage that by resetting the pacemaker every morning, just as you might reset your watch every day if it tended to run slow. In humans, the only proven way to adjust the clock, other than with certain medications, is through exposure to light. Light travels into your eyes and stimulates your retina. Some of that information is relayed directly to the biological clock in the hypothalamus, in effect telling the clock the correct time. If the clock's current internal setting is incorrect, it starts to adjust in the appropriate direction. That is why your body normally runs according to your local time, and why you can adjust your schedule when you travel to a different time zone. The reason it takes several days to adapt to a new time zone is that, except in specialized laboratory settings, our biological clocks cannot make large adjustments all at once. Light affects the clock differently depending on what time it is inside your body when the exposure occurs. Light at noontime has very little effect, but light after sunset or toward morning makes your body think the day ends later or starts earlier, and so the clock adjusts in the corresponding manner. Activities, meals, and napping can affect your clock setting, but only indirectly by changing the hours you are exposed to light. If you stay up later than usual, after an evening nap, or if you get up extra early one morning for an appointment, you will be exposed to light at times when you would normally be asleep. And if you are used to eating in the middle of the night, you will definitely be exposed to light at the wrong time. Certain regular and predictable aspects of our daily schedules develop through habit or necessity, regardless of the circadian pacemaker's setting. For example, although we generally feel hungriest near our typical meal times, if we force ourselves to eat at different times, we will eventually learn to get hungry at those times instead, even if the rest of our daily schedule, including when we sleep, is unchanged. To a degree, even nap times can be changed independently of nighttime sleep hours. If meals, napping, and daytime activities do not follow any regular schedule, our physiological rhythms become disorganized and uncoordinated, and feelings of hunger and sleepiness begin to occur at unpredictable and inappropriate times of the day. If we don't sleep regular hours at night, this disorientation worsens, Now these rhythms no longer function in concert at all, as they should. Our bodies do not seem to know whether it is time for a snack or a big meal, for a brief evening nap, or an early bedtime. Some of our circadian rhythms may be set for sleep, while others are at levels associated with waking. Jet lag is the same phenomenon in another guise. When you first travel to a different time zone, your body's clock remains set to the time zone you left. You try to conform to the new schedule, staying awake and active during the daylight hours and sleeping when it is night there, but your body, unable to reset its internal clock instantly, wants to wake and sleep at times based on the clock at home. As your rhythms adjust to the new time zone, they may do so at different rates. Thus, for a while, not only are they at the wrong setting, but they are also out of sync. You feel drowsy and unwell during the day, and you sleep poorly at night. If you follow the new schedule consistently, your circadian clock and all the physiological systems under its control will eventually adjust. But if you don't keep to a regular schedule, perhaps while traveling or even routinely at home, your rhythms may never work in harmony. If you are a shift worker, the symptoms are probably familiar. You have to try to sleep when you feel wakeful and get up when you want to sleep. If you change shifts too frequently, your sleep rhythms cannot stabilize. At home, you may continually suffer from sleep problems, and at work, you may never feel fully awake. Sleep phases. The term sleep phase refers to the period of time that starts when you or your child become sleepy enough to fall asleep for the night, and ends when you wake spontaneously in the morning after getting all the sleep you need. If because you don't get enough sleep during the week, you are tired enough to fall asleep unusually early some nights, or to sleep extra late in the morning, it may be difficult to determine your sleep requirement and your sleep phase exactly. They will be easier to determine when you are on vacation. However, it is usually easy to make a very good estimate of how much daily sleep children need and what times of the day and night they are capable of getting it. Refer to Chapters 1 and 2. If you want to get a real sense of how your sleep phase affects you and the way you feel, stay up all night reading a book. The evening will probably go by without trouble. However, after a while, you will begin to feel sleepy. This point of sleep readiness often comes on quite suddenly. Now your eyes no longer stay open of their own accord. In fact, it becomes a struggle to keep them open and focused, and it becomes difficult to pay attention to your reading. You may feel cold and want to get under a blanket. If you gave in and allowed your eyes to close, you would probably be asleep within a minute or two. These signs mean that you have passed from your wake phase into your sleep phase, or, using different terms that mean the same thing, from your wake zone into your sleep zone. Now it's easier to fall asleep than to stay awake. If you fight off the sleepiness, you may find that after half an hour or so, you briefly feel more awake, but soon the sleepiness returns again, even more powerfully. This alteration between periods of relatively heightened and lessened alertness, known as the basic rest-activity cycle, continues all night and through the day as well. But the overall tendency is to grow sleepier during the night and to become more alert toward morning. If you stay awake until perhaps 4 o'clock in the morning, you will probably feel terrible. All your body rhythms are set for sleep. Your temperature and steroid levels are low, you may be a little nauseated, and the thought of staying awake for the entire upcoming day is awful. But if you manage to remain awake a few hours more, until the point in the morning at which you would ordinarily wake up spontaneously, the end of your sleep phase and the start of your wake phase, you will notice a surprising improvement. All your body rhythms are switching back to wake. Hunger is a good sign that you have reached this point. After a shower and some breakfast, you probably won't feel all that bad, even though you have had no sleep at all. What you're experiencing is the effect of your circadian system. Your body moves into wake mode, whether you have slept or not. If you are like most people, you can tolerate a single sleepless night without great impairment. In fact, you probably won't go to sleep much earlier than usual the next night. That is, your sleep phase will not shift earlier to compensate for the lost sleep. And that night, you probably won't sleep much more than usual. The key point to remember is that it is hard to sleep in your wake phase and hard to stay awake in your sleep phase. This idea will be important in Chapter 10 when we start to discuss sleep schedule problems. The circadian system and the forbidden zone for sleep. Why you can stay awake until bedtime and sleep until morning. If you were to graph your level of alertness while you stayed up all night, the result would be a rough U-shaped curve. You get progressively sleepier, then start to feel more awake toward morning. On a normal night when you're sleeping, the pattern is a little different. There is a bump of lightened sleep and potentially increased alertness in the middle of the night. See Figure 9 in your PDF companion. That's why it's often easier to get up to use the bathroom at 3 a.m. than it is an hour after falling asleep, or an hour before your usual wake-up time. The pattern of alertness during the daytime is similar. Rather than following a simple inverted U-curve, or even just declining from morning to night, alertness during the day follows roughly a mirror image of the nighttime pattern, with a dip in the middle of the day corresponding to the nighttime bump. You do become fully alert soon after waking, and you do get progressively sleepier as the day goes on, but you go through a stretch of especially low alertness in the mid-afternoon. Again, see Figure 9 in your PDF companion. Children on a one-nap schedule take their nap at this point or become cranky. Adults can nap for an hour or so at this point, too, if they let themselves, as is routine in siesta cultures. If not, they will still probably take a relaxing break from whatever work they are doing. Even if you don't nap, you'll begin to feel more alert as you move past this midday dip, and you will soon be wide awake again. If you usually stay up relatively late at night, the dip may not actually hit until after dinner. In the evening, during the few hours before the start of your sleep phase, you enter the forbidden zone for sleep, an especially interesting period in which sleep is nearly impossible. If you tested your ability to nap at various times of the day, you would find it the most difficult to fall asleep during these evening hours. On the contrary, at those times you feel more awake, alert, and focused than ever. The same applies to your child. In fact, awareness of the forbidden zone turns out to be critical for understanding and treating certain common sleep problems in children. All parents see the effects of the forbidden zone on children, though they may not understand what they are seeing. When your child seems sleepy in the afternoon or around dinner time, but gets a surprising second wind just when you want to send her to bed, it might seem strange. This is the forbidden zone at work. The longest period of sustained wakefulness occurs at the end of the day, not in the morning. That is before, not after, the longest period of sleep. That is why your child seems so energetic all of a sudden, ready for fun, or just about anything except going to bed. Even in a four-month-old who naps three times a day, the evening nap is the shortest and will be the next one to be dropped altogether. Why is this so? Don't we get sleepier the longer we stay awake and less able to stay asleep the longer we do sleep? We do, in part, and this effect is caused by the so-called homeostatic drive, one of the two main factors influencing sleepiness and alertness. If that were the only cause of sleepiness, we would get progressively sleepy across the day, and the drive to sleep would decrease progressively while we sleep at night. We would have trouble staying awake until dinner time, and difficulty staying asleep until morning. Since we exhibit neither of these patterns, and in fact we can function reasonably well during the day after getting no sleep at all the night before, there must be other causes of increasing and decreasing sleepiness across the day and night. The other major influence is the circadian drive, a direct effect of the biological clock. The circadian system works in opposition to the homeostatic drive, trying to make us more wakeful as the day progresses and sleepier as the night goes on. The balance between the two enables us to function at fairly consistent levels all day and sleep fairly well at night. See Figure 9 in the PDF. However, near the end of the day, the wakeful component of the circadian system temporarily dominates, causing the forbidden zone or second wind. As we saw before, the circadian drive is so strong that it can overcome the homeostatic drive and keep you alert during the day, even after a full night without sleep. At the start of the sleep phase, the circadian system switches to sleep mode. Now that both systems are working in concert, pushing us toward sleep, it becomes hard to stay awake. Other factors also affect sleepiness and alertness. Age and developmental level, more than anything else, determine one's nighttime sleep requirement and the number of consecutive hours one can remain awake. That is why an infant needs several naps during the day, while an older child or adult needs fewer or none. Losing sleep night after night builds up a sleep debt, which essentially enhances the homeostatic drive so that the level of alertness is lowered over the whole day. Napping during the day does the opposite, removing some of the drive to sleep. That allows young children to make it through the day, but it also makes it easier to stay up late and more difficult to fall asleep at night, especially for older children and adolescents. Medication can increase the drive to sleep, sedatives and antihistamines, for example, or the drive to stay awake, coffee and other stimulants. Illness can have similar effects. Fever usually makes you sleepy. Pain usually keeps you awake. Psychological and cognitive factors affect sleep, too. Depression sometimes increases sleepiness, especially in children, while anxiety can interfere with the ability to fall asleep. Setting the biological clock. How do you know what time zone you are in? Recall that exposure to light sets your biological clock and adjusts the timing of your sleep phase. Bright light near bedtime delays your sleep phase so that you fall asleep later and wake spontaneously later. Bright light in the morning has the opposite effect, causing you to wake earlier and fall asleep earlier. If you are exposed to bright light within your sleep phase, that is, after you would usually fall asleep, or before you would usually wake spontaneously, its effects are especially strong. Exactly what happens depends on the timing, intensity, and duration of the light exposure. For example, suppose your current sleep phase runs from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Now imagine that you begin staying up until midnight every night, sitting in front of a bank of bright lights from 9 o'clock on. Also, imagine that you put on a blindfold when you go to bed and wear it until 9 o'clock in the morning. You are now getting 3 extra hours of light at night and 3 extra hours of darkness in the morning. Over the next several days, your sleep phase will delay, move later, by those same 3 hours. Soon you will be unable to fall asleep until midnight, and you will not wake spontaneously until 9 o'clock in the morning. In effect, that is precisely what happens when you travel from New York to Los Angeles, cross 3 time zones, and get exposed to evening and morning light 3 hours later than you're used to. Now consider the opposite experiment. This time you wear the blindfold from 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the evening and get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to sit in front of bright lights for 3 hours. Now the nighttime darkness starts 3 hours earlier than you're used to, and so does the light in the early morning. Within a few days, your sleep phase will advance, move earlier, by those 3 hours. Soon you will be falling asleep at 6 o'clock p.m. and waking at 3 o'clock a.m. This type of change, of course, is what happens when you travel from Los Angeles to New York. Actually, your biological clock normally undergoes small adjustments of this kind every day. As we saw earlier in this chapter, our circadian clocks naturally run slow. Left alone, they will run on a cycle about 10 minutes longer than a true 24 hours. In practice, the cycle is closer to 25 hours, probably because we are regularly exposed to electric lights after the sun goes down. Not as bright as sunlight, but still bright enough to have an effect, and not exposed to light while we sleep indoors in the morning. The result is that we have a tendency to go to sleep and wake up almost an hour later every day. In fact, many of us do just that, on weekends and while on vacation. Come Sunday night or the end of a vacation, it's difficult to go to sleep at our usual weekday time, and the next morning it's harder than ever to get up for work or school. So why doesn't our sleep schedule constantly drift later and later? It's because most days, like it or not, we have to get up at the same early time. And when we do, we are exposed to light. That morning light pushes our schedule earlier, usually enough, or almost enough, to counteract the drifting tendency. It keeps us running in place. But when we're free to sleep late every day, as a toddler may be, or even just on weekends and vacations, we do start to drift. As we will see later in the book, this drifting is behind one of the most commonly seen sleep problems. Individual differences. Are you a lark or an owl? In any discussion of sleep schedules, it's important to take individual factors into account. The forbidden zone seems very powerful for some, less so for others. This difference may be explainable in part by the traits of morning and evening preference, which divide people into the types known as larks and owls. Owls are people who get energized at night. Their second wind is strong, and the late night is often the most pleasant time of their whole day. Owls feel most alert at that time. They can think clearly, study effectively, and play well. Staying up late is easy for them. But owls have a problem in the morning. Waking up and starting the day, even after a full night's sleep, is painful and difficult, like climbing out of a deep hole. Owls don't like to get up, and they avoid early morning activities whenever they can. It's easy for an owl to become phase delayed, as discussed in Chapter 10. For larks, the second wind is less forceful. As night falls, larks feel as if they are sliding into the same deep hole that owls wake up from each morning. Finding it unpleasant to stay up late, larks may pass up evening activities or leave them early. But they wake up without any trouble early in the morning, usually feeling great. They want to get right up and start doing things. For larks, morning is the best time of the day, and evening is the worst. They are less likely than owls to develop a phase delay. On the contrary, their sleep phase may be earlier, more advanced, than they or their parents desire. Refer to Chapter 10. People do not necessarily fall entirely into either of these categories, but most have a tendency in one direction or the other, and in many, the preference is quite strong. Although this is an innate preference that does not change over time and cannot be taught. Owls can follow an early schedule, and larks a late one, if circumstances demand it, albeit probably not happily. In fact, larks and owls show genuine biological differences. For example, in owls, body temperature reaches its lowest point of the night nearer the time of morning waking than it does in larks. A specific gene has even been associated with the lark trait. Larkness and owlness exist as traits even in young children. A toddler who is an owl is especially energetic at night. She wants to be part of anything going on anywhere. She can stay up later than usual without difficulty. If her bedtime isn't pleasant, or if its timing is not enforced regularly, the entire process of going to bed may deteriorate, and her schedule may become delayed or grow variable and unpredictable. The one problem she is unlikely to have is that of early wakings. A toddler who is a lark, on the other hand, will probably like going to sleep early. If for some reason you don't put her to bed on time, she may grab her teddy bear and go to sleep on her own at bedtime, wherever she happens to be, and regardless of anything going on around her. Bedtime for such a child is unlikely to be a problem, but she may be wide awake and ready to go at 5 o'clock in the morning. Society, sleep deprivation, and the adolescent. We live in a sleep-deprived and phase-delayed culture. From adolescence until retirement, few people get enough sleep. How many of us wake up in the morning because we've slept enough? How many of us can get up on time without an alarm or someone waking us? How many people would not sleep later if they could? How many don't sleep later on weekends and on vacation than they do on work days or school days? The reasons for our cultural sleep deprivation are complex, and there are no easy solutions. First of all, we are exposed to light for several hours between sunset and bedtime. Morning sunlight works to keep us from drifting, but it can't always completely cancel out the effect of all that artificial light we get at nighttime. If we are also chronically sleep-deprived, though, if we stay up too late and always get up earlier than we would like, the combination of morning light and sleep deprivation can be just enough to counteract the phase-delaying effect of the evening light. This pattern is usually not seen before adolescence, since that is when youngsters first gain the freedom and ability to stay up late. Second, the electronic world continues non-stop, day and night. The days are long gone when the only thing on television from late evening till morning was a test pattern. Shows aimed at adolescents and young adults continue until the early morning hours. Teenagers give up sleep for the shows they enjoy. Younger children will also give up sleep for television, but more often at the other end of the night, getting up early to watch cartoons. The internet is always on. Video games are always available, and the telephone always works. Nowadays, all of these activities are accessible no matter where you live. In many places, restaurants, bars, movies, and arcades stay open very late as well. Third, sleep is not a high priority for most people. When faced with a choice between sleep and another activity, most will choose the other activity. It is ingrained in our culture that you should be able to get by on little sleep most of the time and catch up occasionally. It's a rare adolescent who willingly leaves her friends at 9 o'clock to go home and sleep. Not many adults do either. Conscientious adolescents may feel that it is more important to finish their homework than to go to sleep early, and most of their parents and teachers would agree. People wrongly believe that even when they are tired, their abilities to work, learn, and drive are unimpaired. Study after study has shown otherwise. Yet, though most people understand that it is unsafe to drink and drive, few realize that driving under the influence of sleep deprivation can be just as dangerous. When is the last time you handed over your car keys because you got only 6 hours sleep the night before? The news is full of stories about teenagers whose lives were lost when they fell asleep at the wheel and drifted into oncoming traffic or continued straight when the road curved. More teenagers die in car accidents than from any other cause. In the United States, more than 100,000 car accidents and 1,500 deaths each year occur because of drowsy driving, and most single-vehicle accidents not caused by alcohol are due to lack of sleep. The drivers in about half of these accidents are teenage boys or young men. Furthermore, the effects of alcohol and sleep deprivation are cumulative. Just one beer can have a devastating effect on a 17-year-old who has slept only 5 hours. Adolescence in our culture is a recipe for sleep schedule problems and sleep deprivation. Even without taking cultural factors into account, adolescents' nighttime sleep is shallower and less restorative than the sleep of younger children, and the ability to nap during the day comes back. Thus, even under the best of conditions, a teenager is sleepier in the daytime than she was as a child. At the same time, she is better able to fight off sleep and stay up late. She also develops the ability to oversleep, that is, to sleep longer at one stretch than she really needs, or at least to repeatedly return to sleep until the late morning or into the afternoon. Preteens generally get the amount of sleep they need and then get up. Finally, some evidence suggests that adolescents have an inherent sleep phase delay. They naturally fall asleep and wake later in the day relative to light exposure than younger children do. Compounding the problem, in most places, high school starts earlier than elementary and middle school. In some areas, students who take the bus have to get up as early as 5:30 a.m.